Alright.
Okay, we're a little bit late, but we say good morning to you, and you are listening to the Lowell Association for the Blind's LAB Radio. And the LAB Radio is a member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network, and we can be your main source of accessible community news and information, and we're located here in Lowell, Massachusetts, and we read local news, editorials, and feature stories and more. The LAB Radio is brought to you by volunteers and staff of the Lowell Association for the Blind. Again, good morning. My name is David. I am a volunteer. I am in the interview room. I have Josh. Good morning, Josh.
Good morning, everybody.
And he is in the control room. And I will be reading to you from the Lowell Sun on Sunday, yesterday, December 4th. And I think Josh is going to read today's paper.
I have Saturday's.
Oh, you have Saturday's paper for the Lowell Sun. So, we're going to fill you in with everything that's in the Lowell Sun over the weekend. And, okay, so here is the lead article at the top of the fold for Sunday in the Lowell Sun. It says, "It put a smile on his face." And then below it, in a little bit of a smaller print, it says, "Lowell General gives donated knitwear quilts to cancer patients." And this is coming out of Lowell. For Sambe Saracen of Draycott, 2017 was a different year. Her husband, Larry, was diagnosed with prostate cancer the year prior. And the couple took many trips to the Lowell General Hospital Cancer Center, where Larry received treatment before passing away in June. Though the circumstances were bleak, Sassanane recalls a small amount of joy that first winter. Post-diagnosis, a red knitted hat someone had donated to patients at the center. "My husband, he was an outdoor person and had many hats at home. But for some reason, when he saw one hat, he picked it up and he put it on. He liked it very much. It put a smile on his face," Sassanane said. "He was so happy that he got that hat, so it made him feel happy. That made me feel happy also." Sassanane returned to the cancer center last week, dropping off 24 scarves she knitted as a way to both honor her husband's memory and offer that same gesture of love and hope for patients like Larry. "A small table in the cancer center is often filled with winter hats, scarves, quilts, and other handcrafts items for patients to take at will." Emily Lemire, the manager of oncology social work at the center, said it's a source of comfort. "I think a lot of people coming through the cancer center are going through a really hard time in their lives. They're sort of frozen. They're dealing with the feelings of fear and depression and anxiety and the unknown," Lemire said. "The biggest thing for us is the smiles that it puts on these people's faces, no matter what they're going through. For several years now, patients have taken those thoughtful gestures with them as they battle a deadly disease, though Lemire said she's not sure how long they've accepted donations. Starting in mid-November, Lemire said donations kick into overdrive as they expect." I have to turn to page 5. And let's see. "As they expect a couple of donation bags every week in the lead-up to Christmas and New Year's. Receiving everything from mastectomy pillows to chemo hats, Lemire said they don't hold on to anything, and everything can be repurchased and gifted to the patients they serve. They've touched because someone else made something that they're not reaping the benefit, that they're now reaping the benefit," she said. Donna Reed, oh, that's an old actress name.
Oh.
Yeah, Donna Reed, oh my God. I remember, that was in the 1950s, and I remember Donna, I think it was the Donna Reed show, and I was in love with her.
Oh.
But of course, I was a little boy, about 6. Donna Reed, the Chelmsford of Chelmsford dealt with three bouts of breast cancer, first in 1999, and then 9 years later again around 2016. Having visited Lowell General for all her treatments, Reed said she's been thrilled with her doctors, radiation technicians, and other staff. But a highlight of her experience was that donation table. She took a hat while battling her second round of cancer, a hat she said she still owns today. It made me feel good that people who had the ability were willing to just sit and knit hats. Oh, what a nice story this is. I always thought it was nice little touch that someone was thinking about people who were going through cancer treatment. While visiting her 93-year-old father at Lowell General this week, Jean Arena of North Chelmsford dropped off several quilts and pillows to the cancer center. It was where her husband of 35 years, Joe, was treated for leukemia. Arena said they planned to retire together before Joe passed away in October of 2021. While many hours to fill in the day and a love for quilt making, Arena said crafting and donating her work made her feel better, like she was doing something that would have made Joe proud. Since April or so, Arena said she's given 30 to 35 quilts to the hospital. I saw a lot of patients come through when Joe was going through treatment, and a lot of people are alone. It made me sad, Arena said. My family knows I've been doing this, but I don't talk about it. It's just something I do. For those interested in donating, the Cancer Center only accepts new items, and a representative of the hospital suggested people call ahead to know what is most needed. The center also takes monetary donations, which also support cancer patients, and those can be made by contacting the hospital's philanthropy department. Like Sayasane and Arena, many donations come from individual people who seek to make a difference in the community, Lemire said. But groups will also bring in things like market basket gift cards, puzzles, blankets, handwritten notes of encouragement from children. Winter gear, warm knitwear, and other gifts made a big impact in patients' lives and on their well-being, Lemire said. But it's important to understand that donations are welcome and necessary year-round. Cancer doesn't stop just with the holidays, Lemire said. They can donate any time of the year, but sometimes off-season is nice also. Wow, okay. Never think about those kind of situations. So, okay, Josh, I'll turn it to you.
All right. From the Saturday's Lowell Sun, first headline here on the front page, man arrested on drug charge. A 19-year-old Lowell man was charged with trafficking cocaine after police said he was caught with 210 grams of the drug in the Acre neighborhood on Wednesday. Qualic Owens, who was charged with trafficking in 200 grams or more of cocaine, was on probation at the time of his arrest for a previous cocaine trafficking charge he received in Lowell last year, according to police records available in court documents. Owens' latest arrest on Wednesday afternoon came as detectives with the Lowell Police Department's Special Investigations Section conducted surveillance in the Acre neighborhood for narcotics-related activity. Police reports state detectives have been involved in multiple arrests and observed numerous narcotics transactions in the area. Shortly before 2 p.m., police reports state detectives observed what appeared to be a drug transaction take place inside a vehicle in a parking lot in the 100 block of Fletcher Street. A detective with his badge visible approached the two males involved in the alleged transaction, including Owens in the area of Fletcher and Franklin Streets. Police reports state detectives knew Owens from several previous encounters. Owens was arrested in July 2021 on the charge of trafficking 36 or more grams of cocaine when Lowell police caught him with nearly 45 grams of crack cocaine, according to police reports. Owens' case was continued without a finding and he was put on probation until July 2026. If he were to get into further legal trouble during that time, the case would be dismissed at the end of his probation. When the detective made contact with Owens, the 19-year-old allegedly turned and ran, police reports state. Following a brief foot pursuit, Owens was tackled to the ground by a detective and handcuffed. Continuing on page 8 here. As they began searching his person, Owens allegedly told detectives, "You already know what's in my pocket, so just take it." Police reports state detectives allegedly found a clear, large, vacuum-sealed bag in Owens' jacket pocket that contained a substance that would later test positive for cocaine. According to police reports, a detective jokingly asked another detective on scene if the quantity discovered was an 8-ball or 3.5 grams of cocaine, to which Qualick interjected into our conversation by stating, "It's clearly way more. You guys are idiots." In addition to cocaine trafficking, Owens was charged with resisting arrest for allegedly running from detectives. Owens was arraigned on the charges in Lowell District Court by Judge Michael Fabry on Thursday. He was held on $2,500 cash bail and is slated to return to court for pre-trial conference on December 22nd. So he can still get bail for $2,500 even though he violated probation and had like over 200 grams of cocaine that he was actively caught selling.
Yeah, that doesn't make sense. You're on probation and now you're selling cocaine and then you get...
You should absolutely... There should be no bail for this person.
Not only that, but for the guy to say to the police officer, if I heard you right, "Well, you guys are idiots. It's heavier than you think, and there's more of it." I mean, you know, this is just, you know.
Wow. Yeah. Okay.
All set?
I don't know. All right, I'm going to pass it back to you, David.
Okay, all righty. Let's see now. I have here, I'm back to the Sunday paper, and it says, "The Mass GOP leadership race heats up." Really? And then it says below it, "Some candidates vow to forego salary to change party direction." Okay. The Mass GOP chairman, Jim Lyons, rakes in roughly, $100,000 a year as leader of a party that failed to win a single statewide election this November. So here's a guy getting $100,000 to head up the Mass GOP, and he failed to win one single statewide election in November, a salary that two candidates eyeing his job vowed not to take amid the state committee's fundraising difficulties. "I have made a commitment to do the job without a salary," said Amy Carnival, a longtime Massachusetts GOP committee member who was mulling a run for the chair. John Featherston, a former chair of the Ashland Town Republican Committee and longtime host of All Politics is Local podcast, said he would also forego a salary. I have to turn to page 9. Is that here? Yeah, okay. Page 9. Where am I? Okay. And work the chair position as a volunteer. While Carnival said she plans to make a decision on whether to seek party leadership before Christmas, Featherston said Friday he is definitely running and will make a formal announcement in the next couple of days. Per its bylaws, the Massachusetts GOP committee has to elect a new chair in January, but the meeting has not yet been scheduled, and committee members are hearing that it could be pushed until the end of the month, said the Herald has learned. Oh, the Herald? I'm reading the Lowell Sun, right? Yeah. Given that the Mass GOP State Committee has been operating without a budget for the entirety of 2022, it's unclear how much salary Lyons is taking home this year, Carnival said. Carnival said Lyons' salary was budgeted at $97,500 in 2020. Mass GOP Assistant Treasurer Anthony Ventresca, who cuts the paycheck, said the committee did not vote any increase in the salary since that time. But Carnival, citing a conversation she had Friday with Mass GOP Budget Committee Chairperson Patricia St. Aubin, said that since fundraising has been down, there were months that Lyons did not take a salary. Ventresca declined to comment on what months or during how many Lyons was not getting paid. Lyons has not said whether he will run for a third term and did not respond to a request for comment on Friday. But Committee Vice Chair Jay Fleitman, who was jockeying for chairmanship, said Lyons provided him with a timeline prior to the election. "Before I decided to run, I sat down and had lunch with him," Fleitman said. "I told him if he did poorly in the elections, I was going to run. In our discussions, he mentioned to me that he would make a decision about whether to run sometime this month in December. Okay. Fleitman, a doctor, who announced his run for chair the morning after the election, said he expects Lyons will make a decision that is appropriate for the party as well as for himself and his family. I think he respected the fact that I'm going to do this, he said. I think I will respect whatever decision he makes in terms of whether he's going to run. I think that's the way we left it. In contrast to Carnival and Featherston, Fleitman said he would take a salary if he were to be elected chair, saying that since he lives in Western Mass, he would incur an additional expense in having to find an apartment in Boston or one of the suburbs. Part of taking a salary would accomplish that. Christopher Lyon, a political consultant who declared his candidacy Friday, also said he had no intention to work pro bono. I would take a salary because I think it's a full-time job, Lyon said. I view it as a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week, 365-day-a-year job. I think Jim Lyons is getting paid about $100,000. In my opinion, that's not a lot of money. Well, okay.
Yeah, I don't know what you do, but...
Okay, Josh, that's not a lot of money. Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. The candidates vying for chair may disagree on salary, but they all agree that they think it's time for new leadership. Okay. The heavy losses further splintered a party that for years has been marked by two clear factions led by the more conservative Trump supporter Lyons and moderate outgoing Governor Charlie Baker. The candidates attributed the lack of fundraising success or committee leadership's unwillingness to raise funds for or support certain candidates such as Charlie Baker's endorsed pick for state auditor Anthony Amore as a contributing factor in those election losses. Massachusetts Republicans don't always agree on a lot. But I think most Massachusetts Republicans acknowledge, at least privately, that we need to make some changes. Fleitman said that there were a lot of things that were problematic with the election. The Mass GOP committee does not have the structures in place to support its candidates, not only financially, he said, and there were problems with some of the selected candidates. Well, the fact that you had just had an election and not one of your guys won.
Yeah.
I would say, yeah, somebody's not doing something correctly.
Yeah, no kidding.
Okay, I'll turn it to you, Josh.
All right, another headline from the front page here. Christmas Eve robber sentenced to 12 years in prison. Michael Vangpa, 33, of Dracut, robbed three convenience stores in Lowell and Tewksbury at gunpoint. Boston. The Dracut man who terrorized greater... Why is this story from Boston, even though it doesn't take place anywhere near Boston? It takes place in these areas. Kind of weird. Anyways, or maybe that's where the court sentencing is, I don't know. But anyways, the Dracut man, who terrorized Greater Lowell convenience stores at gunpoint on Christmas Eve in 2020, was sentenced in federal court on Thursday to 12 years in prison. Michael Vangpa, 33, robbed two convenience stores in Lowell and another in Tewksbury within an hour on December 24, 2020, discharging a gun and pistol-whipping store employees along the way, according to a press release from U.S. Attorney Rachel Rollins' office. The first of three armed robberies occurred at around 2 a.m. at the 7-Eleven at 63 Mammoth Road in Lowell. A criminal complaint filed in U.S. District Court states a masked and armed Vangpa entered the store demanding money from the store's cashier before firing a round from the handgun. Cashier handed over $60 from the register and about $600 worth of cigarettes to Vangpa before he fled the scene. All this for $60 and a bunch of cigarettes. Wow. The discharged round did not strike anyone during the robbery, but it was recovered by Lowell police and ended up being a key piece of evidence in Vangpa's arrest in August 2021, the criminal complaint states. At 2:15 a.m., the criminal complaint states Vangpa then entered the 7-Eleven at 55 Chelmsford Street in Lowell, again demanding money and this time striking the cashier in the back of the head with the handgun before leaving the store with $200 from the register. The The final robbery occurred at Circle K at 1785 Andover Street in Tewksbury at about 2:35 a.m., at which point the criminal complaint states Vangpa again struck the cashier in the back of the head with a handgun before fleeing with about $1,600 from the cash register. At the time of his arrest, the criminal complaint states Vangpa was on probation for a 2016 armed robbery conviction stemming from a bank robbery in Lowell in 2014. How do you get on probation after robbing a bank at gunpoint? I don't understand these. Police said Vangpa robbed the Bank of America at 724 Chelmsford Street on December 13, 2014. Not just one, but two banks, the TD Bank at 350 Westford Street the following day. How did these people get out on bail? In July, Vangpa pleaded guilty to three counts of interfering with commerce by robbery and one count of using a firearm in furtherance of a crime of violence. Mr. Vangpa's acts of violence spread panic across the communities he violated and terrorized by committing multiple armed robberies, Rollins said in a press release the day Vangpa admitted guilt. Residents should be able to visit their local businesses without fear. In addition to the prison sentence, Vangpa was sentenced in court by U.S. District Court Judge Leo T. Sorokin on Thursday to 5 years of supervised release in addition to his 12 years in prison. I was going to say for a minute there. Police departments in Lowell, Tewksbury, Draycott, and Nashua each provided assistance in the investigation, according to Rollins' office. Assistant U.S. Attorney Charles Del Ano of Rollins' Major Crimes Unit prosecuted the case. Vangpa's attorney, Forrest Emil Greenberg, was not immediately available for comment. So really, this guy made out with $2,000 and some cigarettes and is now going to spend 12 years in jail. And after that, 5 years supervised release in his 40s.
Well,
was it really worth it?
Well, the good news is that he's not going to be around in the public for a long time.
So,
all right. I'm back to the Eagle Tribune. And it says here, police capture man wanted for attempted murder. And this is coming out of Pelham, New Hampshire. A 21-year-old Haverhill, Massachusetts man, who police said was wanted for attempted murder in Lawrence, was captured by police in Pelham on Friday night. The Pelham Police Department said in a press release that Seth Castillo was taken into custody without incident at a plaza on Bridge Street following a coordinated effort by police from Pelham and Lawrence. Following his arrest, Castillo was charged in New Hampshire with being a fugitive from justice. In his home state, he faces charge of armed assault to murder, carrying a loaded firearm without a license, carrying a firearm without a license. Why did they repeat that? Oh, wait. Carrying a loaded firearm without a license. Then carrying a firearm without a license. So if you carry a firearm that's loaded, that's an offense. If you carry a firearm that's unloaded, that's still an offense. So those are different offenses.
Yeah.
Assault and battery with a dangerous weapon and discharging a firearm within 500 feet of a building. The police department, criminal bureau, was contacted by the Lawrence gang unit at about 6:30 Friday night, seeking assistance in locating Castillo, who was thought to be in Pelham. Police said Pelham police detectives were able to locate Castillo in a plaza located at 30 Bridge Street. I'm trying to think where 30 Bridge Street is. Oh, I think it's just just over the line from Lowell. The plaza was placed under surveillance by detectives while patrol units were stationed in the area. Shortly before 7:50 p.m., members of the Pelham and Lawrence Police Departments took Castillo into custody. He was transferred to the custody of the Hillsborough County House of Correction for a pending extradition hearing. The details of the allegations against Castillo regarding the crime in Lawrence was not provided by police. Well, that was a pretty short article, and I'm just hoping that if you're being wanted for attempted murder, I don't think you should be getting any low bail.
No, I don't think so.
You know,
I don't think if you're attempted murder, you should be getting any bail.
I would agree with you there also. Okay, Josh, I'll turn it back to you.
All right, I got a couple of small articles here that I can read. The first one, another crime story from the local news section on page 3. Woman, sentenced for stealing $64,000 from bank. A Tewksbury woman who stole more than $64,000 from the bank she was employed by to support her gambling addiction avoided incarceration.
How is that possible?
In federal court on Thursday, U.S. Senior District Court Judge Raya Zobel sentenced Gina Rogers, 46, to 3 years of supervised release, with 3 months of that time served under home detention, according to a press release from the U.S. Attorney Rachel Rollins' office. The release states Rogers stole bank deposits totaling $64,495 from Citizens Bank in Waltham while working as a teller and vault custodian at the bank. On August 10th, Rogers pleaded guilty to one count of bank theft, which included a potential prison sentence. Rogers' attorney, Jane Peachy, requested that the court sentence her client to time served, followed by 3 years of supervised release. So we don't know how much the time served was. So she has been in jail.
I thought you said it was 3 months.
So that's after her, that's her supervised release is the 3 months.
Oh.
So time served, they don't say how long she's already been in jail for the crime pending her hearing, I guess. The request was granted. A sentence involving no term incarceration was the right result in this case, Peachy wrote in an email to The Sun. According to a sentencing memorandum filed by Peachy in U.S. District Court, Rogers was fired from Citizens Bank in February 2020 for stealing. Peachy wrote in the paperwork, Rogers stole the money to support her gambling addiction. Since her arrest, Peachy wrote in the document, Rogers has attended therapy and meetings to address her addiction and its root causes, which were born out of childhood trauma and postpartum depression. She has been able to refrain from gambling for over a year now while building a strong network of support, Peachy said in the documents. Peachy added that Rogers has no prior criminal history. I don't think that really matters when you're stealing $65,000, but okay. In addition to Rollins, Rogers' sentencing was announced on Thursday by Kenny Larco Ward, inspector in charge of the U.S. Postal Inspection Service in Boston. Why would the Postal Service be announcing her sentence? That's kind of weird. Assistance in the investigation was provided by the Waltham Police Department, Assistant U.S. Attorney David G. Tobin of Rollins Major Crimes Unit prosecuted the case. And I got one little article here. Quasi Quilters hosting quilt raffle. Townsend. The Senior Center's Quasi Quilters are set to host the latest raffle, according to club member Kathy Spalding. On Saturday, December 10th, as part of the Public Library and Senior Center's Holiday Fair and Festival of Trees, the club will award a single 85-inch by 85-inch quilt to the raffle winner. Tickets are available for purchase at the Senior Center for $5 each or three for $10, and according to Spalding, will also be available for purchase on the day of the fair. Proceeds will be used to finance the club's quilting supplies. A philanthropic group, the club raised more than $3,000 for Ukrainian refugees earlier this year. Spalding said those funds are very important as the club does everything they can to help those in need. This is just so important for us, Spalding said. Obviously, we love quilting, but we also love donating, doing whatever we can to come together to try and help those in need. So it's important that we have some money set aside for supplies so we can buy what we need as we need it, and we keep doing that. Giving back, it's just what quilters do. So if you can buy a ticket and take the chance on a quilt, give from your heart and help us give back, she said. For more information, visit the Townsend Senior Center on 16 Dudley Road. All right, I'll pass it to you, Debbie.
Okay, I was just looking at this next article, and this one is kind of interesting. It says Polynesian Pride, and then it says a three-day canoe voyage in the mid-Pacific.
Ooh,
3 days canoeing in the mid-Pacific. All right?
Huh.
Well, okay, so it says, it starts in Chile, And it says the causes are worthy, the course is daunting. Almost 500 kilometers or 300 miles across the stretch of the Pacific Ocean in a large canoe. So you're in an open little boat in a canoe.
But wow.
I'm looking at the middle of the ocean.
Interesting.
Yeah, okay. And it's the Hoki Mahi Challenge, which started Saturday in Chile. And it's better known as the Easter Island. That's where it starts. And the event consists of a canoe voyage in which 9 Rap Nunis, which I guess is the local people, 2 Chileans, and 1 Hawaiian. So that's 9, 10, 11, that's 12 people, seek to raise awareness about the importance of women in the world, urge protection of the environment, and celebrate the union of the islands of Polynesia. Okay, now, the 12 athletes, have been training 6 days a week since mid-September, preparing for a voyage that will take them from Chile to Manto Maturo Haiva, another island in the mid-Pacific that also belongs to Chile. Then someone says, it won't be easy, said Gil's Borders coordinator. 3 days and three nights. Now, you're in a canoe for 3 days and three nights. How do you go to the bathroom?
Yeah, I don't know.
I mean,
I'm not sure how that works.
3 days and three nights. Borders moved to Chile early this year, but he has lived, I thought it was a woman, has lived in Polynesia for 3 decades, devoting much of his time to rowing. I'm very grateful to all the Tahitians for teaching me their culture and how to row. You need teaching on how to row? I mean, I know, you get the basics down in 5 minutes, don't you?
Yeah, I would think so. They must do something sort of a little bit more extreme then, I guess.
I came from France, but they accepted me and allowed me to share this with them. Okay. The Hoki Mahi pursues 3 goals. The first is to honor canoeing in Polynesian, which has been practiced for centuries. The second relates to the environment. And also, the third purpose relates to gender equality. The team will carry a small female Moai, M-O-A-I, one of the ancient statues that Easter Island infamous for, to raise awareness about the importance of women in the world. I already know that women are important. I don't need you to take the canoe ride. During the voyage, rowing will be done in relays. Groups of 6 will row for about 4 hours, then be replaced by the next shift. Those who need to rest will do so in a Chilean Navy ship. Okay, all right.
So okay.
Escorting the canoe. So I guess you paddle for 4 hours, get off, in the Navy ship, go to the bathroom, have a meal. You know, so it's not as like they're just going for...
Sitting in the canoe for that long, 3 days and three nights.
Yeah. The training has been hard, especially for those of us who are less experienced, says Contour Aitan, a 36-year-old historian. Aitan said the crew member invited him to join a few months ago while he was out paddling a one-person canoe. Is there a one-person canoe?
Probably. They're probably smaller, I would imagine. I've never seen one personally.
And you kind of sit in the middle?
I would think so.
He told me, I need you to come on Tuesdays and Thursdays to help us. They're looking for volunteers from Lowell. Are you interested?
I'm all set.
Okay. On training days, they often started before dawn to get accustomed to the darkness that they will be facing. We practice rowing at night. We practice getting little sleep. Well, I just don't know. Could there be sharks out there? That you're only a couple of feet over the waterline.
I would think so. But I think that's partially why they have that.
Maybe
that
so.
Other ship with them too, especially if like a storm happens or something, like you'd easily get.
I would hope that they, when they say you see a fin out of the water, you start shooting at it.
Yeah.
Spiritually and sacredness are pervasive in Chile, including with cooking rituals and songs about their history. Sports also incorporated spirituality. Several days before the trip, the canoe built for the Hoki Mai were blessed with the Umu, E-U-M-U, which involves cooking underground with hot stones in a sacred ceremony. We did it with a white chicken. I don't get all this. It's something spiritual. Okay, eating a piece of a connection to our roots. Their cultural legacy is also linked to the Moai, M-O-A-I, like the one they'll carry with them to their final destination. Carved in volcanic stone between 1000 and 1600 A.D., from the slopes of the Reno Raku volcano, they represent the ancestors of the various clans whose descendants still inhabit Chile. Chile. You say Chile, right? Not Chile.
Chile, I think, yeah.
Is it Chile or Chile?
I think it's Chile. I think is the, supposed to be the real pronunciation of it.
Okay. And let's see. So that's kind of basically the article, but I mean... Yeah, I don't think I'm going to be signing up for that.
I think I'm okay. All the power to them if it's a good cause and have at it. I mean, don't think that's for me either.
Being in a canoe, on the ocean, in the Pacific.
Yeah, you're not just paddling up the river here.
Correct. Correct, yeah. All right. I'll turn it back to you, Josh.
All right. I got a couple more small articles here. COVID wastewater data spikes 88%. By Rick Sobey. The Boston area COVID wastewater data has surged almost 90% in the last couple of weeks, as state health officials on Thursday reported a weekly increase of more than 5,000 confirmed COVID cases. The virus wastewater data is the earliest indicator of COVID cases at the community level, and the sewage data has helped predict waves throughout the pandemic. The south of Boston region has seen a significant spike in COVID wastewater levels in the past 2 weeks, especially after Thanksgiving. No real surprise there. The seven-day average in the southern region is now 937 viral copies per millimeter, which is up 88% since mid-November. The north of Boston region's 7-day average is now 759 viral copies per millimeter, which is a 94% jump during the last 2 weeks. Meanwhile, the state's daily average of 724 COVID cases from the last week is up from the daily rate of 632 virus infections during the previous week. The state's positive test average is rising again. The 7-day positive test rate is now 7.14%, a jump from 5.59% last week. The state also reported that 650 total patients are hospitalized with COVID, which is an increase of 88 patients from this time last week. The state reported 63 new COVID deaths over the past week. Wow, I can't believe it's still...
Yeah.
People are still dying from it, surprisingly. Bringing the state's total to 22,488 recorded deaths since the start of the pandemic. The daily average of deaths now is 8, which is lower than the daily death rate during the initial Omicron surge. That's still kind of a surprising amount.
I agree.
More than 5.5 million...
22,000 since the beginning, and it's 8,000 a day. No,
8 a day now.
8 a day.
It's still kind of a surprise now.
I am too, with all the vaccines that we have and stuff. But
all the other drugs that they come out with to you now, I'm still a little surprised. But
it would be interesting to know, since COVID started, how many people have died from the flu virus?
Yeah.
And how many are dying every day of the flu, just to get a comparison.
A comparison, yeah. More than 5.5 million people in the state have been fully vaccinated, and more than 3.4 million have received at least one booster dose. Also, the state reported that almost 1.4 million additional booster doses have been administered. This holiday season, make the time to get an updated COVID booster, the State Department of Public Health tweeted on Thursday. It can help protect you and your loved ones against new variants. Schedule your appointment today at mass.gov/COVID booster. And I got another quick one here. Macron hits New Orleans French Quarter to boost ties. New Orleans. French President Emmanuel Macron arrived Friday in Louisiana, the American state most closely aligned historically with this country, to celebrate their long-standing cultural ties and also discuss energy policy and climate change. Macron met with political leaders and strolled through New Orleans' historic French Quarter, the heart of the city, stopping to talk and shake hands with bystanders. He paused next to a street brass band and nodded and clapped as they played When the Saints Go Marching In. This is the first by a French president since Valéry Giscard d'Estaing, I believe is how that's pronounced, traveled to Lafayette and New Orleans in 1976. The only other French president to visit Louisiana was Charles de Gaulle in 1960. Macron's itinerary started at Jackson Square. New Orleans Mayor LaToya Santrell walked him to the historic New Orleans collection, where Macron discussed climate change impacts with Governor John Bel Edwards. The French president also met with energy company representatives. The state visit enables us to put France and with France Europe at the heart of the American agenda. That is a good thing, Macron told journalists in French, according to a translation from Pool Reporters. Macron told Edwards he was overcome by the reception in the city. What I think this signifies is a special relationship we have with France. It is historical and cultural, Edwards said. Edwards, a Democrat, has been outspoken about the perils of climate change in a state where tens of thousands of jobs are tied to the oil and gas industry. This makes the stop to New Orleans very emblematic of climate-related efforts, French officials said. During a brief meeting in the presence of Macron, the governor and minister for Europe and Foreign Affairs, Catherine Colonna, signed a memorandum of understanding to further expand and enhance the strong cultural connections between France and Louisiana in the area of economy, clean energy, and the environment, Edwards' office said. Like me, President Macron believes that climate change is real, Edwards said. The governor's office said the agreement formally creates a Louisiana-based position for a French technical expert on the transition to clean energy. During Macron's visit to Washington on Thursday, he and President Joe Biden released a joint statement expressing their deep concern regarding the growing impact of climate change and nature loss and said they intend to continue to galvanize domestic and global action to address it. Louisiana is named for Louis the 14th, the famous Sun King who ruled France for 72 years starting in 1643. New Orleans is where the Louisiana Purchase was finalized. The deal transferred the Louisiana territory, which encompassed much of what is today the central United States, from France to the U.S. in 1803. Macron's New Orleans visit included a stop with First Lady Bridget Macron at the Cabildo, where ceremonies marking the land transfer were held. Macron is also scheduled to visit the New Orleans Museum of Art and dine downtown before departing. Holding the U.S. and French flags, Christine Geisler, who was born in France and moved to Louisiana 6 years ago, was one of the spectators who stood in the streets hoping to see the president Friday. She was thrilled that she got to shake Macron's hand and have a brief conversation with him in French. All right, David, I'm going to pass it back to you.
Okay, this will be the last article before we take our break. It says here, and this is a terrible story, but I have to, I guess I need to read it. I don't know if I have to, but I will. It says, body of 7-year-old Texas girl found, FedEx driver arrested. Terrible. And this is coming out of Paradise, Texas. A 7-year-old Texas girl has been found dead. Poor thing. 2 days after being reported missing and a FedEx delivery driver arrested in her death. The body of Athena Strand was found Friday, and Tanner Lynn Horner, 31, was arrested on kidnapping and murder charges after confessing to killing the girl and telling authorities where to find her body. Horner remained jailed Saturday on $1.5 million bond. I wouldn't give him any
bond,
but okay, I don't think he's getting out. Jail records did not list an attorney. Atkins said during a late Friday news conference that a tip led authorities to Horner, who the sheriff said had made a delivery to the girl's home shortly before she disappeared. Oh, God. Horner did not know the girl's family, according to Aiken, who declined to discuss a motive. We really can't get into the content of the confession, but I will say we have a confession from Horner. The girl's stepmother had reported her missing on Wednesday from the family home near Paradise on the northwestern outskirts of the Dallas-Fort Worth metropolitan area. Her body was found near the town of Boyd, about 6 miles southeast of Paradise. James Dwyer, acting special agent in charge of the FBI's Dallas field office, said FedEx cooperated with the investigation. FedEx said in a statement that it is working with law enforcement agencies investigating the case. Our thoughts are with the family of Athena Strand during the most difficult time, according to the statement. Words cannot describe our shock and our sorrow surrounding this tragic event. How terrible. I mean, poor little girl. I mean, terrible. Okay. So, on that note, unfortunately, it's not a great ending for the beginning show here. You are listening to the Lowell Association for the Blind's LAB Radio. And the LAB Radio is a member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. And the LAB Radio would like to thank UMass Lowell's WUML-FM for providing the radio signal that allows us to broadcast 5 days a week. We're going to take a 15-minute break. I think Elizabeth's going to be back in the control room.
Yep.
And thank you, Josh,
for this
morning's reading. And Josh is going to switch you now over to the Marshfield Broadcasting. Bye-bye for now.
Brought to you by United Way and the Ad Council.
My name is Ruth Rusey, and this is how I live United. I read to children as part of United Way's education program. It helps them create links between language and literacy and prepares them for a better academic future. I figure I have the time and they have the need. My name is Ruth Rusey. I help kids prepare to succeed in school. So I don't just wear the shirt, I live it.
Give, advocate, volunteer, live United. Go to liveunited.org. Brought to you by United Way and the Ad Council. This is the Talking Information Center, a window to independence through local volunteers reading over 300 newspapers, magazines, and books specific to your community.
Now available on your smart speaker by saying, play radio station Talking Information Center.
For comments and more information, call 781-834-4400 or visit ticnetwork.org.
Thank you for listening.
WDBF Libero, WRS Libero, WRSIP Pittsfield, WLLA Legendary, WVAA MPFL, WDJM.
Coming up next from the Talking Information Center is the reading of the Washington Post. Please stay tuned to hear selected articles from this newspaper.
Hi, this is Bridget with the Washington Post. From chicken wings to used cars, inflation begins to ease its grip. But there's still a long way to go before consumers feel much relief or the Federal Reserve hits its goal of a 2% annual price target. By David J. Lynch. The price of gasoline is dropping like a rock. Chicken wings are suddenly a bargain, and retailers drowning in excess inventory are looking to make a deal. After more than a year of high inflation, many consumers are finally starting to catch a break. Even apartment rents and car prices, two items that hammered millions of household budgets this year, are no longer spiraling out of control. Global supply chains are finally operating normally as more consumers spend more on in-person services like restaurant meals and less on goods like furniture and computers that come from an ocean away. The cost of sending a standard 40-foot container from China to the U.S. West Coast is $1,935, down more than 90% from its September 2021 peak of $20,586, according to the online freight marketplace Freightos. The moderation in inflation is just beginning to appear in government statistics. In October, the Federal Reserve's preferred price gauge, the Personal Consumption Expenditures Index, posted its smallest monthly increase since September of last year and is up 6% over the past 12 months. The better-known Consumer Price Index is rising at an annual rate of 7.7%, down from 9.1% in June. The worst of the inflation is behind us, said Stephen Blitz, chief U.S. economist for T.S. Lombard in New York. The question is, where does inflation settle? The Fed has been raising interest rates sharply since March in a bid to get inflation back to its 2% price stability target. Fed Chair Jerome H. Powell on Wednesday noted signs of progress, but said it was far too early to claim victory. Friday's stronger-than-expected jobs report, which showed wages rising too quickly for policymakers' tastes, only underscored the point. The central bank does not expect to reach its inflation goal until 2025. It will take substantially more evidence to give comfort than inflation is actually declining. By any standard, inflation remains much too high, Powell told an audience at the Brookings Institution. Still, there are clear signs of improvement in merchandise prices as consumers resume their pre-pandemic spending patterns. Excluding volatile food and energy prices, goods prices rose in October by 5.1%, down from a 12.3% annual rate in February. But as goods prices begin cooling, pressure is building on services. Rising demand and limited supply, think short-staffed restaurants, has services inflation running at an annual 6.7% rate, more than twice the year-ago figure. The expectation is that goods prices will continue to disinflate, but services inflation will more gradually slow and will be much stickier, said Kathy Bastianchik, chief economist at Nationwide. Most of what is happening now with prices reflects developments in specific markets or consumers' return to pre-pandemic routines. The plunge in ocean shipping costs by itself has stripped roughly 0.7 percentage points from the inflation rate, Freightos chief executive Zvi Schreiber said. By making credit more expensive, the Fed has put a major dent in the housing industry. With mortgage rates briefly topping 7% recently, pending home sales in October were 37% lower than 1 year earlier, according to the National Association of Realtors. But the full effect on the economy of higher interest rates will take many months to materialize. Either way, consumers are unimpressed. Less than 1% of those responding to a recent Census Bureau survey said they had noticed prices for goods and services declining over the past 2 months. And 15.7% of households said they find it very difficult to pay their routine household expenses, a figure that is virtually unchanged from the 15.9% who reported affordability woes in June. To be sure, in a $26 trillion economy, prices on some products are always falling even as many others rise. In June, when inflation reached its highest point in more than 40 years, prices nonetheless dropped that month for bacon, window coverings, and men's sweaters, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. So it's important not to exaggerate the recent improvement. That said, the global economic backdrop has shifted. With Europe and the United Kingdom in recession, and China hobbled by its restrictive zero-COVID policy, global demand for oil has sagged. A barrel of Brent crude now goes for about $85, one-third less than in early March following Russia's invasion of Ukraine. As a result, the national average price for a gallon of regular gasoline is $3.47, down almost 8% from 1 month ago, according to AAA. Many retailers find themselves with unusually high inventories, the result of 2 years of herky-jerky supply chains. But as shipping and raw materials costs declined, companies such as IKEA recently began reducing selected prices. Tolga Anku, retail operations manager for Inka Group, IKEA's corporate parent, told Reuters this week he was quite optimistic about being able to lower additional prices in the months ahead. The company did not reply to a request for comment. Walmart also said last month that it will be looking for opportunities to cut prices. Sam's Club, the company's warehouse membership store, recently cut the cost of its in-house hot dog and soda combo to $1.38 from $1.50, undercutting rival Costco. Living with high prices through this year has a cumulative impact on our customers, especially for those that are most budget-conscious, and so we're focused on bringing our costs and prices down as quickly as possible by item and category, Walmart chief executive Doug McMillon told investors in November. chicken, cars, and rents provide clues as to why forecasters expect inflation to ease in coming months, even if it takes years to return to the Fed's 2% target. Chicken prices spiked near an all-time high earlier this year. COVID restrictions on poultry plants, coupled with an unexpected decline in the number of chicks hatching successfully, led to a drop in supplies as demand was soaring. "It just created a ton of price pressure," said Matt Bisardo, a market reporter for Urner Barry, a food industry information provider. The situation reversed this fall when production rebounded just in time for the typical seasonal decline in demand. The amount of chicken in cold storage jumped nearly 20% since May, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture. That's created some bargains, at least for restaurants. Wholesale prices for boneless chicken breasts have dropped dramatically over the past 6 months, Bisardo said. At Wingstop, a fast food chain based in Dallas, executives said the cost of bone-in chicken wings fell by nearly 43% in the quarter ending September 24th. "We have a favorable commodity outlook, not only for bone-in wings, but also for breast meat, which we believe will continue into early 2023. Alex Kaleida, Wingstop's chief financial officer, told investors October 26th. The company hasn't lowered retail prices, but said it's offering a new chicken sandwich for $5.29 and a combo meal of 20 wings and a large order of fries for $16.99 to share the savings. After soaring in 2021, wholesale used car prices are down 15% from January, according to Manheim, an Atlanta-based automobile auction company. And those declines are starting to show up in prices paid by consumers, said Jonathan Smoke, chief economist for Cox Automotive. New car prices will be slower to react. Dealers at the end of October had 1.56 million vehicles in stock, the highest figure since May 2021. That was enough to cover 49 days of sales, up substantially from 1 year ago, but still well below the pre-pandemic figure of 86, according to Cox. More ample supplies mean fewer customers are paying above the manufacturer's suggested retail price, a common occurrence during the pandemic. The average new car sold in October for $46,991, which was $230 above the MSRP, according to Edmunds, a car shopping website. In May, the average buyer paid $721 above list price. Improving conditions in the new car market also are drawing buyers away from the used car market, which contributes to lower demand and falling prices on those lots. The used market has benefited from abnormal demand throughout the pandemic as a result of consumers being forced to buy used, who could have or would have preferred to buy new, Smoke said via email. Apartment rents, meanwhile, after moving steadily higher all year, are finally cooling. The national average rent for a two-bedroom apartment is up 8.1% from 1 year ago, down from April's 14.6% rate, according to Zumper, an online rental marketplace. The change has been especially striking in cities such as Boise, Phoenix, and Austin, which benefited as employees moved to take advantage of the work-from-home era. Rental prices are cooling off, and cooling off faster than anyone ever expected, said Zoomer chief executive Anthemos Georgiades. 23 is going to be a far more affordable year for renters. Real-time rental data takes months to show up in government statistics, Powell said in his Brookings speech, but it will start contributing to lower inflation readings next year, which explains why most forecasters expect a steady decline in inflation. The Fed expects its preferred inflation gauge, the PCE index, to hit 2.8% by the end of next year, down from 6% today. Teens embrace AP class featuring Black history, a subject under attack. The new advanced placement class on African American studies comes amid new state laws restricting how historical racism is taught. By Sidney Trent, Baltimore. The lesson on historical racism in the United States started with an exploration of Haitian voodoo and its American cousin, voodoo. Broaching such a topic would probably be verboten in an increasing number of public schools, raising the hackles of conservative politicians and parents, and in some places even violating state laws about the way black history and the roots of racism are taught. Yet, on a recent fall morning in Patrice Frazier's Advanced Placement African American Studies class at Baltimore Polytechnic Institute, the intertwined religions were the centerpiece of the freewheeling discussion. "So when you hear the word voodoo, what do you think?" asked Frazier, an outgoing woman with short reddish hair and a paisley shirt, as she strode purposefully among her 30 students seated in 7 neat rows of desks. One by one, the students ventured answers. "Scary. New Orleans. Magic. Witchcraft," said Ayanna Thompson, a senior in a gray shirt and face mask seated near the wall. Frazier laid out the day's lesson. "Let's talk about voodoo and Santeria and how they've been demonized through history, and why they've been demonized," she said. Images flashed on a projector screen at the front of the classroom, and with that, the debunking began. Baltimore Polytechnic, a selective, mostly black, magnet high school with about 1,600 students, is one of about 60 public high schools nationwide that were chosen to pilot the Advanced Placement course, the first new offering from the College Board since 2014. The interdisciplinary class, which in addition to history will span literature, political science, art, and other subjects, will eventually be offered to all interested U.S. high schools starting in the 2024-25 school year. If approved, it would be the first high school course in African American studies that enables students to receive credit and advanced placement in college. A spokesman for the College Board provided a press release but declined to answer questions, including about the course content or the names and locations of the pilot schools. In addition to Baltimore Polytechnic, high schools in Memphis, Brooklyn, and Tallahassee, as well as Frederick Douglass High School in Upper Marlboro, Maryland, are among those offering the class, according to media reports. The new class, a decade in the making, is debuting during a contentious political debate about how students learn history, with conservatives accusing educators of teaching critical race theory and banning lessons they believe might be hurtful to the self-image of white children. So far this year, 36 states have introduced 137 bills seeking to restrict teaching, mostly about race and gender, according to PEN America, a free speech organization. Among the most controversial is a Florida law signed last spring by Republican Governor Ron DeSantis, which states in part, a person should not be instructed that he or she must feel guilt, anguish, or other forms of psychological distress for actions in which he or she played no part. Yet public concerns over the teaching of race and racism coexist with a surging popular interest in black history and historical racism that grew stronger during the racial justice protests of 2020. Museums, movies, media outlets, and books addressing the topics have multiplied. Some school districts, including those in New York City, Newark, Chicago, and Detroit, have added black history courses or sought to infuse the subject throughout the curriculum. The Advanced Placement African American Studies class took root in this rising curiosity as more students and teachers began requesting a course, according to the College Board. Even before that, however, a cadre of public school teachers and administrators, among them then Prince George's County School Superintendent John Deasy, began lobbying the College Board to develop a class in African American history. Early proponents saw the course as a way of encouraging more black students to take advanced placement classes as preparation for college. They also believed that the class could instill self-esteem in black teens, a purpose that is diametrically opposed to today's laws designed to protect the feelings of white students. At Baltimore Polytechnic, Frazier believes that classes like hers and the proposed AP class help rectify a fundamental problem in the way the story of African Americans is taught in schools. By focusing scattershot on slavery and black Americans' freedom struggle, reflexively illustrated by familiar figures such as Harriet Tubman, Frederick Douglass, and the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., African American history does not begin and end with slavery, said Frazier. A a 49-year-old Baltimore native who has been teaching an elective African-American studies course at the school for half of her 23-year career. The sweep of the subject starts with a whole continent of people and countries, people who came to this country with ideas and values and who are doing amazing things. For black students, absorbing just a sliver of this breadth serves the purpose of giving them a sense of pride in their history, but it also draws them further because they're seeing themselves in what they're learning, she said. Illustrious and flawed. In the summer, Frazier and other pilot teachers met at historically black Howard University to review the broad outlines of the course and prepare to teach it. Lessons spanning 400 years, including the origins of the African diaspora, the slave trade, culture and community, resistance and abolition, reconstruction, black freedom movements, and contemporary debates. As with all advanced placement courses, while the teachers must cover the overarching topics, they have considerable latitude in deciding the specifics of and materials for instruction. As they shape their lessons, members of the pilot cohort are relying on one another for ideas and problem-solving through an online community. The College Board has also enlisted about 20 professors to help shape the course. The aim is to avoid the kind of oversimplification that suggests all black people are good and all white people are bad, said Evelyn Brooks Higginbotham, a professor of African-American studies at Harvard University, who is among the advisors. For example, Higginbotham said, a successful class could force students to struggle with the fact that some Africans sold other Africans, and not just those from enemy tribes, into slavery. Or that one of the men who helped the famous Henry Box Brown escape bondage in Virginia by mailing himself to Philadelphia was white. The purpose is not to indoctrinate them or guide them in some kind of political philosophy. The story is so much more complex than simply white people versus black people, Higginbotham said. On the other hand, the existence of systematic racism cannot be dismissed, she said. To deny that is to deny so many of our laws, she said, including state laws against enslaved people reading and writing, about the legality of selling human beings, the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850, Plessy versus Ferguson, and so on. We are both illustrious and flawed, she said of the nation. As Frazier waited for her students to appear in class, she described her teaching philosophy. I don't teach theory, I teach facts, she said. These things actually happened. There are bad things that happen in history, but you're not talking about that doesn't make them go away. What I want is for my students to question things. They can even question me. Fact from fiction. In Frazier's classroom, frightening images of demonic ceremonies flashed on the screen. Early Hollywood depictions of Haitian voodoo, a religion that originated in West Africa. The video went on to separate fact from fiction. A version of the practice known as voodoo took root in the United States with the enslavement of West Africans in Louisiana, who then merged their religious practices and rituals with those of their Catholic enslavers. Derived from African polytheism and ancestor worship, the faith revolves around the idea that spirits, rather than one god, intercede in the daily lives of humans, and can be conjured by dance, music, snakes, and other practices. The religion deepened its U.S. roots as Haitians fled here during and after the revolt in Haiti from 1791 to 1804. Although the practice had been banned in the country by French enslavers, secret voodoo gatherings had long been used to form political ideas and eventually communicate pro-independence messages. Enslaved people on the island kicked off the Haitian Revolution with a voodoo ceremony. Haiti became the first independent black nation, stoking the fears of the United States not so far to the north. Could the Haitian example lead to rebellion among enslaved people here? Not surprisingly, depictions of Haitian voodoo and voodoo as savage and evil immediately began to proliferate in American popular culture. In 1915, President Woodrow Wilson sent the Marines to Haiti to prevent German influence in the region in the run-up to World War I. The occupiers, who remained until 1933, commanded the nation's resources, committed racist violence, and sent home fantastical tales. their descriptions morphed on American movie screens into scenes of frenzied devil worship, human sacrifices, and zombies. The Magic Island, billed as nonfiction by author William Seabrook, fueled the fire, all in time to coincide with white fears of black power during Reconstruction and help justify the crackdown on black rights known as Jim Crow. As the video ended, Frazier once again paced the room, looking into the alert faces of her students. "Why have we been taught to be afraid of voodoo?" she asked. "During segregation, society used it as a reason why you wouldn't want to be around black people, because they could put a spell on you and use black magic," said Reuben Schreier, one of two students in the class.
Okay, we are back, and you don't look like Elizabeth to me.
Nope, I am returning to you all again.
Okay, okay, so rank was pulled on you again. Okay, all right, here we go. Back to the Lowell Sun, and it says here, I'm on page 4. It says, community fund started for Lowell flood victims. And the article reads, a wave of water tore people from their homes. A wave of hope and help seeks to rebuild those lives. On Friday, the Greater Lowell Community Foundation established the Moody Street Flood Rescue Relief Fund to support residents displaced by the post-Thanksgiving flood in the Acre neighborhood caused by a devastating water main break at the Father Montserrat Boulevard on Father Montserrat Boulevard on November 28th. As we have done for the past 25 years, the GL, which is the Greater Lowell Community Foundation, supports our neighbors. President and CEO Jay Linehan said, "We are grateful and fortunate that so many stepped up to help those in need." Established in 1997, the Greater Lowell Community Foundation is a philanthropic organization comprised of more than 400 funds dedicated to improving the quality of life in 21 neighboring cities and towns. It has financial assets of more than $55 million, of which $35 million flows to the Greater Lowell community. The Moody Street Fund will provide targeted relief to flood-impacted residents. Although there were no reports of physical injury, more than 200 people, mostly low-income seniors and people with disabilities, were evacuated from their units at the City View Towers and relocated to area hotels. For a scale of this disaster, a 12-inch pipe like the one that failed can move nearly 5,000 gallons of water per minute. Can you imagine 5,000 gallons?
That's wild.
Per minute.
Oh,
when
yeah.
Burst, that water explodes to the surface and flows along the path of the least resistance. Several homes on Race Street and the basement of City View Towers, which is owned and managed by the Lowell Housing Authority, were flooded. The hours-long deluge knocked mechanical and electrical building services offline for the foreseeable future and swept away people's immediate sense of security in place. They were separated from their units, their pets, their household belongings, daily routine, and community. According to Linehan, 40 different people representing nonprofits from all over the city met to align services such as transportation, food, personal items, and clothing for the residents. Participants included school committee members, state reps, city leadership, a representative for the U.S. Representative Lori Trahan's office, as well as dozens of local nonprofits. We will work very closely with the LHA to find out who needs what, said Linehan. That must be the Lowell Housing Authority. Who also noted that the fund will be managed without any administrative overhead costs. This will be money and money out. This will be money in and money out, he said. Coalition for a Better Acres offices are just around the corner from the flood zone. An executive director, Wan Chu Chow, said the needs exceed the resources of the Lowell Housing Authority and the Race Street homeowners. This is what needs to be done, she said of Friday. Relocating families is not easy. Relocating five families is difficult. Never mind it, almost 200 families that have to be relocated. In the wake of the disaster, she noted that the dislocated population will require ongoing support. It's not just about the first week, she said. It's about the long term, depending on how long it's going to take for them to be able to get back home. It's time for us to come together and just try to help the Lowell Housing Authority any way we can. I still have more of the article. Do we know, are they still displaced over there?
Yes, they are.
Wow. Oh, my God. I mean, here it is just December 5, but I mean, they said it was November 28, so it's been a week now.
Oh, yeah.
In an email to his staff last Tuesday, the Lowell Housing Authority Assistant Executive Director, Chief Operating Officer Adam Garvey, complimented the work of his team, first responders and city departments, but acknowledged the hard road ahead with repairing the building's damaged infrastructure. Wow. Our staff and city departments performed admirably. It's a very difficult situation, he wrote. The building is out of commission, and we are meeting with our facilities team for initial assessment. I do not have time frames at this time. This is a very unfortunate and uncomfortable event for our residents, but they are safe, and we will be doing everything we can to get them home and ensure that they are comfortable as possible during the restoration. Chow said it was a stressful week, but her spirits were strengthened by the wraparound care and love she felt from the community for the flood victims. My heart was really full with how we are all coming together to help our partner organization in Lowell. Seeing what kind of city we are and how we will work together, especially during these tough times. To learn about how to access the fund, contact the Lowell Housing Authority. To donate to the Greater Lowell Community Foundation's Moody Street Flood Relief Fund, visit glcfoundation.info. Wow, I just can't imagine. You know, I know that the basement of that building got flooded, so that means you probably lost your heating system. I don't know about the sanitation system.
Probably. That's probably a mess, I'm sure.
But, I mean, a week goes by and you can't get in a new boiler or a new heating system in there?
It affected so many places, too.
Thinking of the city tower there where they have the 200 families.
Yeah.
Or 200 people.
Yep.
Wow. Well, okay. I'll turn it to you, Josh.
All right. For many Hawaiians, lava flows are a time to honor and reflect. Honolulu. When Willett, I apologize for mispronounce his name, by the way, Kalaukahaku Akima Akau looks out at the lava flowing from Mauna Loa volcano and makes an offering of gin, tobacco, and coins, she will be taking part in a tradition passed down from her grandfather and other native Hawaiians as a way to honor both the natural and spiritual worlds. Akima Akau said she plans to take her grandchildren with her, and together they will make their offerings and chant to Pele, the Hawaiian deity of volcanoes and fire, who her grandfather used to pay reverence to as a kapuna, a word that can mean ancestor. This is the time for our kupuna, for our people, and for our children to come and witness what is happening as history is being made every day, she said, adding that today's experiences will be added to the next generation's stories, songs, dances, and chants. For many native Hawaiians, an eruption of a volcano like Mauna Loa has a deep yet very personal cultural significance. For many, it can be an opportunity to feel a connection with creation itself through the way lava gives birth to new land, as well as a time to reflect on their own place in the world and the people who came before them. A volcanic eruption is a physical manifestation of so many natural and spiritual forces for Hawaiians, said Ilihia Johnson, a Hawaii Tourism Authority spokesperson who is a native Hawaiian and lives on the Big Island. People who are unfamiliar with that should understand that it's a very personal, very significant thing. To be sure, not all native Hawaiians will feel the need to make a trek to see the lava, but among those who do, some may chant, some may pray to ancestors, and some may honor the moment with hula or dance. Some people may be moved to just kind of observe in silence, meditate, you know, commune with their higher power or their kapuna in their own ways, Gionson said. Kianani Kahualale, apologies if I mispronounce any of these names also, said as a native Hawaiian, she feels moved to honor the movement which will take her children, nieces, nephews, and close friends as close to the lava flow as possible, where they will chant to Pele. Our hupuku will be our voice, she said, using the Hawaiian word for offering. It's not for any kind of show. It's a connection that we're making to Pele, to the land, to Mauna Loa. Many Hawaiians are practicing family traditions that have passed down from elders. Akima Akau, who lives in Kauai on the west side of the Big Island, remembers hearing stories about how her grandfather would fly from Maui or Oahu whenever there was a Big Island lava flow to honor Pele. He would jump on a plane and come to Hawaii Island and give his hupuku offerings of gin, silver dollars, and tobacco, she said. Her grandfather died before she was born, so she doesn't know exactly why he chose those items, but he wasn't alone. She said she grew up knowing others who offered the same items, so that is what her family will bring. She said the children will offer Pele a tea leaf lei. All right, I'm going to pass it back to you, David.
Okay, I'm back to the Lowell Sun, and I'm on the opinion page from yesterday, Sunday's paper. And it reads, the state's opioid crisis remains a primary focus. And then it says below it, there's more work to be done. In a profession known as hyperbole, that sentiment is uncharacteristic understatement. Despite the strides made in Massachusetts to counter the opioid epidemic, it is a belief shared by both the state and incoming and outgoing chief executive officers. State government has invested millions in recovery programs, destigmatizing opioid use disorder, bolstering law enforcement's ability to get fentanyl off the streets, and holding opioid manufacturers accountable for irresponsible marketing and production. Governor Charlie Baker, Lieutenant Governor Karen Polito, and Attorney General Maura Healey said at a roundtable discussion Tuesday at a New Way Peer Recovery Center in Quincy. Still, opioid overdoses have increased dramatically since 2000 and remain at elevated levels. A 2018 report from the Department of Public Health data provides a snapshot of the significant growth of the opioid crisis since 2000. When 379 Massachusetts residents died of opioid-related overdoses. 379 Mass residents died. Okay. The 2,290 confirmed and suspected overdose deaths logged last year represents a 500% increase since 2000. In 2021, the rate of opioid deaths year-over-year in Massachusetts climbed to 9%, a level that surpasses the state's previous high of 2016. Department of Public Health Commissioner Margaret Cook said at a Public Health Council meeting in June that while the 9% climb from 2020 to 2021 is significantly lower than the national trends, it is problematic for Massachusetts. Department of Public Health data tracked an overdose rate of 32.6 people per 100,000. Last year's death rate, the department said in its opioid report, exceeded 6.2% the previous peak of 30.7 per 100,000 residents. Nationally, recent data from the Center for Disease Control and Prevention suggested in the past year, someone in this country died of a drug overdose about every 5 minutes. Someone dies every 5 minutes in this country from an overdose. It's another tragic footnote in this nation's struggle to rein in this escalating epidemic. The number of overdose deaths nationwide last year rose almost 15% to nearly 108,000. Fentanyl continues to be the cause of most fatal overdoses. That's synthetic opioids 80 to 100 times more potent than morphine or methamphetamine or synthetic stimulant, according to the U.S. Drug Enforcement Agency. Last year, overdose deaths involving fentanyl and other synthetic opioids in the country rose 23% to more than 71,000. The lack of available treatment has definitely contributed to these fatal overdoses. Baker said Tuesday that COVID-19 was an incredible blow to the progress and the momentum that we had developed here in Massachusetts before the pandemic. But he did give credit to those in the medical community responsible for our state's relative success in battling one epidemic, opioid addiction, in the midst of a pandemic, COVID-19. But I will say this, while everybody's numbers look worse than they did before the pandemic, ours looks dramatically better than they look in many other parts of the country, Baker said. I give many of the people in this room and many of your colleagues around the Commonwealth enormous credit for finding ways to hold on to and stay with so many of the people you served and supported during these difficult times. Commenting back in June on the DPH data, Baker stated, "Today's report underscores the harmful effect that the COVID-19 pandemic and the scourge of fentanyl have had on those struggling with addiction, and we are committed to continuing our work with the legislature and our colleagues in the addiction and recovery community to boost access to services and treatment." But with Baker leaving office in early January, the executive duty now falls to Healey. As Attorney General, she's well aware of the vital role law enforcement plays in the interdiction of these addictive substances and prosecution of those who profit from them. She also understands, as do attorneys general in every other state, that this opioid trail extends far beyond our nation's borders. It starts with the raw products in China, subsequently refined in Mexico, that eventually flows through our country's porous entry ports via land, sea, and air. Given that every state with help from the federal government must do its part, including law enforcement, the medical community, and preemptive education in schools to combat this menace, we believe the other 49 states will do well to emulate the Massachusetts model. Okay, back to you, Josh.
All right, let's see here. We already heard about the flood, so let me go to this article here. Nagarajan named 2022 Distinguished University Professor. An innovator in developing more sustainable and resilient materials, plastics engineering educator Ramaswamy Nagarajan has been named UMass Lowell's 2022 Distinguished University Professor. The annual award honors selected professors for exemplary teaching, research, and service to the university. It is the highest accolade bestowed on a UMass Lowell faculty member. "I am honored and humbled by this recognition," Nagarajan said. "The UMass Lowell community has inspired me and provided me the chance to work collaboratively with our students, faculty, and staff in research, education, and developing innovations that make an impact in many ways. I will be eternally grateful to the university for this opportunity and to my family for their support." A Draket resident, Nagarajan joined the university's internationally acclaimed plastics engineering department, which is housed within the Francis College of Engineering, in 2006. Today, as a tenured professor, he serves as the Senior Director of Strategic Defense Research Projects and Co-Director of the university's Heroes Initiative. In this role, he works with the U.S. Army, scientists, and engineers to develop lighter, stronger, and more protective uniforms, equipment, and portable energy sources for soldiers. Nagarajan also co-directs UMass Lowell's Fabric Discovery Center and the university's Center for Advanced Materials, and partners with the Toxics Use Reduction Institute at UMass Lowell. In his roles, he is pioneering the development of more sustainable, multifaceted substances, including environmentally friendly flame retardants, solar-powered plastics, inks that conduct electricity, flexible electronics, smart clothing. Wow. Quite a list here. And more. Known for his team-building skills, Nagarajan calls on the talents of a wide variety of other UMass Lowell researchers and students in his work, enhancing opportunities for scientific discovery and experiential learning. He has been awarded 77 research grants totaling more than $22 million and holds 20 patents on technology he has developed. In 2011, the UMass Lowell Graduate Student Association honored him with its Faculty Member of the Year Award. Endorsed by 22 faculty members across UMass Lowell's colleges, Nagarajan's nomination for the Distinguished University Professor Honor was led by his colleague, Professor Pradeep Kurup, Chair of UMass Lowell's Civil and Environmental Engineering Department. Professor Nagarajan is an exceptional candidate for this recognition, Kurup wrote in the nomination form. He continually demonstrates visionary approaches in his professional endeavors, having made outstanding contributions both within his field of plastics engineering and across the larger community by engaging in highly acclaimed interdisciplinary research, teaching, and service activities. Nagarajan received his master's and doctoral degrees in plastics engineering from UMass Lowell, along with a bachelor's of technology from Anna University and a bachelor's of science degree from Loyola College, both in India. Nagarajan will serve as Distinguished University Professor until 2025 and deliver a keynote address about his field of study to the campus and community next spring. He is the 15th professor to be recognized since the honor was established at UMass Lowell in 2008. UMass Lowell is a world leader in plastics engineering education. Founded in 1954, the university's department offers the first and largest plastics engineering program in the U.S. to be accredited by the Accreditation Board of Engineering and Technology. Today, more than 3,000 UMass Lowell graduates work in fields that develop and use plastics, helping to advance and improve the sustainability of these materials to meet the needs of the future. All right, back to you, David.
Okay, here's a an article on a motor, on cars. And it says, the first article that someone writes to the newspaper says, I have a 2008 Chrysler Town and Country that I purchased new. I also purchased the Chrysler Lifetime Maximum Warranty. Who would buy a lifetime warranty on a car?
I don't know, unless you really love that specific car. And you,
I mean, how much would it cost for a lifetime warranty? And, yeah, you're going to keep it? I mean, okay. So now the person says the ABS, brake, ESP, BAS, anti-skid warning lights came on. Okay. So this is a 2008, so this car is 14 years old now. My dealership inspected the vehicle and tried to order a new sensor. They notified me that the one was not available either new or aftermarket. This is why I purchased the lifetime warranty. No, you got to realize that sometimes parts aren't manufactured anymore for old cars.
No, they go out of service, and a lot of parts are designed to fail. They can make them to last forever, but they're not going to because, well, you're not going to make money on the parts if they last forever.
And that is called planned obsolescence.
Yes.
Okay, so then he writes, my service person said I still could drive it, but ABS will not work and that Chrysler would probably have to total the vehicle and offer me market value. Now, if you're going to offer me market value for a 2008 car, I don't think you're going to get much money. It didn't say replacement value. It said market value.
Okay, that kind of depends because now a lot of those older cars that were like, and used cars have shot up in price.
No, but this thing's 14 years old.
Yeah,
this thing's half your age.
Yeah, just about.
Okay, the vehicle looks and runs like new. Mm-hmm. I am still driving it and would like to hear what you think. So the person writes back, the service writer must not be aware that the ABS wheel speed sensors are readily available in the aftermarket from a variety of manufacturers and a variety of auto parts stores. Yes, perhaps the original equipment part is unavailable from the dealership. So obviously the dealer wasn't willing to really search for that part and just kind of get you out.
Yeah. Well, especially when they're that old. I mean, 14 years for a part, I mean, that's kind of slim pickings. You know, you're likely not going to find it.
I know. Okay, next article. Not article, but next question. I like to shift my automatic transmission, which 99% of the cars now are automatic transmission. I like to shift it into neutral when I'm stopped at the traffic lights.
Why?
wait a minute. But you're right. Why? If I'm on a level road. Again, why? Right, okay. Is this a good practice? That's the question. It gives me my right leg. Now, this is just incredible. It gives my right leg a break from not holding the brake pedal.
Oh, come.
I know. This is serious. I am careful not to let my truck roll. So the guy's driving a truck. And what are the pros and cons? Well, first of all, immediately when I saw that, if your leg needs to rest, then you've got some physical issue.
That maybe you shouldn't be driving,
right?
Yeah.
You know, but okay, so they write back and says, the practice neither helps nor hurts. But there could be issues if you need to accelerate away from a vehicle about to rear end you, you know. If you do get hit, leaving your foot off the brakes could also cause your car to crash into the one in front of you. Your insurance company may consider this a collision when you file a claim and cite you as being at fault. If your leg needs a rest, shift into park.
Yeah, that way your car's not moving anywhere.
You know,
I wouldn't think you'd need to let your leg rest, though, on an average day of driving.
I know. I don't get it. Well, he said truck, so I don't know. I don't know. But, you know, I always told my wife, and, you know, if it ever happens, hopefully she and I will have that sense to do that. If you know how sometimes they'll say that the accelerator gets stuck down?
Uh-huh.
I says, Donna, if you can think about it real quick, put the car in neutral.
Yeah, because then it won't go anywhere.
Yeah. The engine will continue to rev up, but at least you're in neutral.
Yeah.
You know, but, you know, if your accelerator gets down to the pedal, you know, all the way down, hopefully you have that mindset.
To notice that it's stuck and,
I don't know.
Down
I don't
instead
know,
of panicking.
Yeah. Okay. Okay, next question. My car maintenance service suggests I get an oil change every 3 or 4 months, assuming I drive about 10,000 miles between changes. So that makes sense, because it's either once a year or 10,000 miles.
Really?
This is my car, and I have synthetic oil.
Okay, I still do about every 5,000. It's around every 5,000 miles, it's supposed to be.
Okay, but I have synthetic oil, so I don't know, my car.
I mean, it depends on your vehicle, I would think. A lot of people, typically, they've always told me 5,000, even though I'd use synthetic oil now.
Okay, so mine's every 12 months or every 10,000 miles, whichever comes first.
Yep.
So the reminder sticker, that they put on my windshield shows that my next oil change was due last March at 53,000 miles. Since I drive only about 5,000 miles a year, and my mileage is only 51,000, I haven't changed the oil yet, so they haven't changed it since March. And this is December, so yeah. Okay. I haven't changed the oil yet. My car is a 2014 Toyota Camry that uses synthetic oil. Do you recommend changing the oil based on the time since less oil change or based on mileage? Well, it's the lowest. I mean, the shortest, you know.
Whichever hits first. Yeah. I think going through, like, the winter and stuff, though, can kind of change up your oil situation, so.
Yeah. Well, the answer is, although they can be a helpful reminder for some motorists, I personally consider those stickers marketing tools to drive repeat business. Follow the maintenance schedule in your owner's manual. Why does someone have to write this? Can't they look at their owner's manual and get that answer?
Probably, yeah.
Okay, here's another one. I have a 2020 RAV4, and my daughter has a 2018 hybrid version. We both have noticed that the windows do not defog well in the winter, especially in the back seat. A problem here in Minnesota for several months a year.
Oh.
When I took mine to the dealership last winter, They told me it was because the carpet was wet. This year, on a cool morning in early October, I noticed it again, and we had no rain or snow. This past week with the snow, I did not drive the car, so there's still no moisture, and still the windows fogged up. Do you have any tips for me? The only way I found to help so that I can see safely to drive is to have a fan on full blast and the back seat windows cracked open, none of which is ideal. Okay, so the answer is, what do you think is the quickest way to warm the car cabin? Set the controls to recirculate? No. Recirculated air picks up moisture, not only from the wet carpet, but from human breathing. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Okay.
You want the fresh air coming in instead of recycle. With every exhale, you add moisture to your environment.
That's fair. Yeah.
Okay. Select the fresh air setting on your HVAC controls, and I have a hunch you will clearly see good results. You have already proven better results with fresh air from the rear window.
So I actually have heard that by hitting the fresh air, it makes the temperature difference inside the car usually warmer than the outside, so it helps it defog quicker.
Oh, okay.
I have heard that. I don't know how well that works in frost in Minnesota.
I never have it on recycle. I want air coming in from the outside. And then you can put the heater on, but I always know that fresh air is coming in there.
Yeah.
Plus, now when you have people in your car, and with COVID, I don't know how much it helps, but I'd rather
not have recycled air, yeah.
Yeah, so. All right. I'm going to turn it back to you, Josh.
All right. I got one more article here, and we'll see where that leads us. Also, just a quick note on that last article. I think it'd probably be best you get the system checked and maybe the heater or something checked out, because if it's really not defogging enough, usually means it's something wrong with the fan or how much heat is getting pulled out. So, just another idea versus having to roll down your windows. But
well, you know, and then there's another thing that I'm just thinking of. The new cars with the batteries instead of, you know, combustion engines with gas, right? When you put on the heater, you're not getting heat from the engine because the engine is not a combustion engine.
Okay.
So the electric cars have to have their own built-in heaters. And so that's drawing more power from that battery.
Yeah.
And so, because I was reading that the other day, and they says, you don't have a combustion engine. You don't have pistons firing.
Yeah, interesting.
So the heat's not coming from the engine.
Yeah.
So I'm just thinking, so as you're looking at, you know, my nephew has a Tesla, and he tells me, oh, David, you need to get a Tesla. And I'm like, I don't want to watch that. The electric battery needle going down, and I'm thinking, should I turn off the heat, and I should, you know, turn off my lights, and, you know.
Yeah.
Because every time you turn on the lights of the car and the heat.
It's using the battery.
It's using the battery, and I'm like, and the other day, we were up in Maine just for the day, and I said to my wife, we need to get some gas. Well, I have just a regular combustion car, there's a gas station right over there. And I said to Donna, if we had a battery car, do you see any infrastructure where I can get my battery charged?
Yeah.
So I don't know. I mean, I don't know where the future is. They need an infrastructure before they start selling.
Absolutely. And that's unfortunate thing is that when you go on trips, you have to actively plan how much charge you have, the stops you're going to have to make in between to be able to charge your car so that you don't run out of energy or break down.
I know.
It's a whole thing. Because they don't have enough power charging like you can. You can stop off at any random gas station or, you know, Cumberland Farms or 7-Eleven, whatever they have with the gas stations to get gas for your regular car, but they don't have
electric charging. Yeah, and, you know, my nephew who has the Tesla, he says you can drive the car from 0 to 60 in 3 seconds. I mean, he said it's like a rocket. It takes off.
Yeah.
Right? And I said to him, well, I'm not so interested in driving a car like that.
Yeah, and that's the thing. Like, who
needs a rocket?
Yeah. So. I don't know anybody that drives like that on a normal street, so I don't see the point of that. But some people like that kind of features. I don't know.
Yeah. I think people that buy Teslas is more for the novelty, or that they can say to people, "Well, I drive.
Oh, I have a Tesla. Yeah.
I have a Tesla, and whatever. But are they really saving the environment? Because you still got to produce electricity,
and you got to produce the batteries that take up a lot of stuff to make the batteries for the cars.
Yeah. So now that I've talked to Josh for all this time, he does not have a final.
That's all right, yeah.
Okay, so we are going to conclude our midday broadcasting, and we would like to thank you for listening to us at the Lowell Association for the Blind's LAB Radio. And the LAB Radio is a member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. And there are many ways to listen to the LAB Radio, and one way is to request a free specialized radio receiver. But for more information at a radioing service, call at the LAB Lab at 978-454-5704. And if you want to get the best service, call for Josh. Ask for Josh.
Absolutely. I'll be here.
Your phone's going to be ringing off the hook. Next way is to listen to the LAB Radio anytime by dialing area code 1-631-359-9069. Or visit our website where you can tune into the LAB Radio at LowellAssociationForTheBlind.org. I am David. I want to thank you for listening. I want to thank Josh for covering both the early segment and the later segment.
Absolutely. My pleasure.
We'll be rebroadcasting today at 4 o'clock.
Yep.
And starting all over again tomorrow at what time? 9 or 10?
9 a.m.
9 a.m. We'll be back on. Okay. Have a nice afternoon. It's sunny and it's beautiful out and chilly.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Bye-bye, everyone.
Mostly cloudy, with rain moving in late in the day, temperatures in the mid-50s. The sun rose this morning at 6:56, setting at 4:11 this evening. Stay tuned for more, heading your way next on the Talking Information Center.
Happy holidays from the Talking Information Center. We want to wish you a joyful and healthy holiday season with hopes for great things to come in the new year.
This is John from the Talking Information Center wishing you a very happy holiday season from all of us here at the Talking Information Center.
This holiday season gives us the chance to tell you how much we appreciate you listening as we look forward to another year of providing you with programs to inform and enjoy.
This is the Talking Information Center, a window to independence through local volunteers reading over 300 newspapers, magazines, and books specific to your community.
Now available on your smart speaker by saying, "Play radio station, Talking Information Center."
For comments and more information, call 781-834-4400 or visit ticnetwork.org.
Thank you for listening.
A
portion of today's broadcast was made possible by South Shore Buds, offering an honest and easy cannabis experience for South Shore locals and vacationers alike. South Shore Buds, located right off Route 3 in Marshfield, features a brilliant and passionate staff who are ready to help you understand the uses and effects of hundreds of products. For whatever experience you're looking for, South Shore Buds is there to guide you to the best fit to meet your needs. For more information, visit their website, southshorebuds.com, or the store at 985 Plain Street in Marshfield.
Coming up next on the Massachusetts Reading Network for your listening pleasure, it's the New York Times. Please stay tuned.
Hello, this is Lynn. And I'll be reading from the New York Times today for Monday, December 5th, 2022. And the first article is, "War and Sanctions Threaten to Thrust Russia's Economy Back in Time." While Russia's economy has not collapsed, an exodus of Western companies is eroding hard-won progress, and experts say the worst may be yet to come. by Valerie Hopkins and Anatoly Kermaniev. Valerie Volodin, a welder at a sprawling Volkswagen plant in western Russia, relaxed for most of the summer at his dacha, or weekend house, planting his garden